I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
So I'm so excited that you're here talking about Christina Pizan. She's amazing, and I'm just thrilled to have you here. So can you introduce her to those of us who might not be so familiar with her?
Sure, no problem. So Christina Pizan was a writer in the late 14th century, early 15th century in France. And she was a professional writer, which was kind of unheard of for women at the time. So she actually supported herself and her kids through writing. Mm-hmm. And she wrote just over 20 works, which is quite a lot at the time. From the time when she was widowed until things got too hot in Paris and she kind of retreated to an abbey for a while. So yeah, she was writing right in the middle of the Hundred Years' War when things were crazy in France. And yeah, she was writing for the court. It was pretty amazing.
Yeah, so can you tell me about how she became a writer? Because like you said, that's so unusual. Even I think for men at this period to just suddenly say, oh, I'm going to be a writer, but especially for a woman to say that, and like how she kind of, how that came about for her.
Yeah, sure. So I think unless you were trained up in the church, it was kind of a strange thing to say you're going to be a writer. So Christine was very unusual in that she came over to France with her father. Her father was a doctor and an astronomer at the court of Charles V. And so her father let her learn some stuff, taught her some stuff, even though her mother was not into that, didn't think girls needed to know that. But Christine loved to learn, even though she says that she was more interested in playing at the time. But so she grew up in the French court, and their family was very pretty wealthy because of her father's position as an advisor to Charles V. So when Christine was 15, she got a bunch of marriage proposals, but she accepted one that was from a court clerk named Etienne de Castel. And so she married him, and it was a love match, and he was already established at the court as well. So he was a clerk, and her father was in the court too. Mm-hmm. And then Charles V died, and his son came into power as a child. And Charles VI was all sorts of a nightmare when it comes to a ruler, because he had a lot of mental health difficulties, and it was a very unstable time. And so Christine's father lost his position, or he was very reduced in his position, so they didn't have much money. And then her father died, and it was just Etienne taking care of the whole family. So Christine, their three kids, and Christine's mom and a niece. And then Etienne went away with the king, and he died. So Christine was 25 years old, and her husband was dead, her father was dead. She had to take care of everyone by herself. And so the only thing she really knew how to do was to write. So she's this 25-year-old widow, and she's dealing with like all of her husband's financial accounts. The only criticism she has of him ever is that he didn't tell her enough about their finances. So she's in court, and she's trying to get people to sponsor her and to write. And so she starts to write ballads and she writes 100 ballads, and people start to like this, and then she starts to write advice books, and then people start to notice, and eventually she's so well known that Charles V's brother, Philip of Burgundy, actually asked Christine to write his brother the king's official biography. So she's really made it at that point, and she's starting to have commissions. She's starting to actually make money off of writing. So she wouldn't have done it if she hadn't been a widow. She would have been established as a wife, which she was quite happy to do. But she said when Etienne died, she transformed. She metamorphosized, and she called herself a man after that. In a poem that she wrote about that transformation. I think it's called The Book of Fortune's Transformation. So she was forced into it, but she was really well suited to it as well.
And did she ever have to pretend that she was a man? I'm thinking about later on in French, right, the famous story about like George Sand and you know, in the 19th century, women writing as men. Did she ever have to do anything like that, or was she?
No, she would never have been able to get away with it because she was too well known. And she was also pretty fierce, and that I don't think she would have wanted to take on someone's name, but she was really trying to build this up for herself, for her family. So yeah, she wouldn't have been able to get away with writing as a man.
Yeah.
She says that it was the novelty of her writing as a woman that made her as successful as she was, which is kind of being a little bit too modest, but there's something there in that no one else was doing it at time. But she didn't actually become a man in any sense of the word.
okay. And so she was writing right around the time of the start of the printing press, right? And I'm wondering how that influenced, if you can say anything about how that influenced how her writing was spread, I guess, or...
Yeah. So she died before the printing press. She died probably around 1430, because the last thing she wrote was about Joan of Arc.
Okay.
She was very, very excited about Joan of Arc. She probably didn't see the end of that story.
Right.
Good for Christine. So the printing press was about 50 years later. But then her work was one of the early things that was put into print. William Caxton printed a couple of the things that she wrote. They were put into English translation, and they were disseminated as printed texts in England, we know, also elsewhere in France as well. But she was writing in a time of manuscripts, and this is really interesting because, as you can see from the shirt, she's herself. She makes sure that there's pictures of herself in these books, and she really supervised how they were made, which is really kind of unusual as well.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
That's really interesting. So she was really hands-on with the whole process, huh?
Yeah, she was really hands-on. And fair enough, because this was all she had to work with. So one thing that you might find interesting, we're talking a little bit about the Tudors, is that her book, The City of Ladies, which we could get into a little bit, explain what it is in a second, but The City of Ladies is one book that was translated into English and put into print around 1521, which was a time when some people have speculated that it might have been to kind of bolster Mary's claim to the throne, because at that time we know that Henry didn't have any sons.
Right. So
Stephanie Downs, I think, was saying this might have been to bolster Mary. And we know that Susan Bell found that in an inventory of Henry VIII's possessions, there were 6 panels of tapestry of the City of Ladies, which was found in Elizabeth's garden room. So the Tudors knew about this book because there's no other book called The City of Ladies. And so there were people that were reading it. We know that the Tudors as well could speak French, at least. Anne Boleyn for sure. And so she was probably exposed to this book either in English or French. So it's weird that Henry had that tapestry, but it's really awesome that it was in Elizabeth's possession. So
yeah. Now see, that's interesting because I had kind of put in the questions I wanted to ask you about Margaret of Austria, and she was the one who Anne Boleyn was at her court, and she was this really humanist Renaissance she was regent for a while and ruled in her own right, and that's who Anne was at her court, and she sponsored a lot of musicians and all of that kind of stuff. And I imagine Anne reading this book and you know, being exposed to her work very early on when she was 12 or 13 years old, and the impression yeah. that it made on her. And that's interesting yeah. to think that even in 1521, when Anne was still not anything yet, that so it wasn't just because of Anne that her work became known in England.
Right. And I don't know a lot about Margaret of Austria, as I told you, but I did quickly look her up, and we do know that some of Christine's works were owned by her. So there is a very good chance that Anne would have been exposed to Christine, if not the City of Ladies.
Yeah.
So we'll say the City of Ladies, because I don't think we've explained that yet.
Right. Yeah. Tell me about the City of Ladies.
So the Book of the City of Ladies kind of came out of this argument that Christine had, this intellectual argument about this older poem called The Romance of the Rose. And The Romance of the Rose started out as just kind of this nice poem about looking for love. And then the author who's writing that died, and someone else took it over, and it became a very misogynist
okay.
book. And so around the time that Christine was writing, people were like, this book is great. It's such a great piece of literature. And she couldn't stand that, so she wrote a bunch of letters saying, this book is terrible. Not only is it, like, dirty, but it's also misogynist. It's terrible. So she wrote this book called The City of Ladies, where it's this dream sort of vision where Christine is sitting in her study, and she's reading about men's ideas of women. And she starts to think to herself, like, all these very learned men have said women are terrible. It must be true. And then she's visited by these three apparitions, Lady Justice, Lady Rectitude, and Lady Reason. And they say to her, Christine, like, this is nonsense. Women are fantastic, and let us show you how they're fantastic. So the three apparitions, they build a city of arguments that are about how women are fantastic. And this city is where women can intellectually live and defend themselves against these arguments that men make. So the City of Ladies is all about examples from the Bible and from mythology and from different arguments that men have made over the years that really say women are fantastic. So she's got Amazons in there, and she's got biblical ladies. And it's just, it's amazing because all of the arguments that are routinely set up against women in the Middle Ages and now, she sets them up and she knocks them down. And it's a revolutionary book. And when I came across it, I was absolutely floored. I just had never read anything like this, didn't know anything about it. We were always told that, you know, women just kind of sat down and were quiet at this time, which is not true at all. But then here is Christine, she's put in writing, and nobody actually persecutes her. Like, we have this idea of the Middle Ages where if you put forth an idea that's controversial, people are just going to take you down, burn you at the stake. Mm-hmm. But Christine was well known, and the Book of Ladies, City of Ladies, was well read, and it was being transmitted and transmitted and transmitted. Now, that said, the last copy in English of it was in 1521 until the 80s.
Okay.
Like the 1980s.
Yeah, yeah.
And so, you know, men were not huge fans of this book.
Yeah.
But at the same time, there were a lot of intellectuals that were reading it and sharing it. And so The City of Ladies is the one that came out in 1521, possibly in support of Mary. We don't know for sure. Mm-hmm. So it could easily have been one that Anne Boleyn was exposed to. And it is the source of the tapestries that I was just talking about, that were found in Henry VIII's inventory. So it's funny because I don't imagine Henry being a big fan of this book, but lots of the very, very strong women in the Tudor court probably would have heard of it, if not read it. So
yeah. And it's interesting because this period in the 16th century in Europe had all of these powerful queens, regnant or regents. So it's interesting to think that they might have all been, you know, reading some of this and being influenced by it throughout Europe as well.
Because there are copies of this that exist, and like I was saying to you, it was in manuscript form, which meant people were really like writing it out. Mm-hmm. which meant that they thought it was important enough to put that effort in. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, it speaks to how powerful her ideas were and how well spread. And it's funny, she was French in the middle of the Hundred Years' War, but she had come to the attention of Henry IV, who she was not a really big fan of. She had a son named Jean, and he had been taken over to England with the Earl of Salisbury as part of Richard II's court in 1397. So if you know this period of history, 1397 is going to set off some alarm bells, right? So he came over with the Earl of Salisbury, and then Richard was overthrown 2 years later. So her son is 15, now at the court of Henry IV, and Henry says, "Christine, you're amazing. I've read your books. Why don't you come over and be my court poet?" And Christine's thinking, like, this is a usurper. Like, there's no way I'll do it. But she told him she would until he gave her son back. And then she was like, nope, I'm staying here. Forget it. So she was well-known and respected enough that Henry IV wanted her to come to England. But she was not having it. So, she was super well-known. And like I said, this is very unusual, but amazing. Like you in your blog post called her a badass, and it's definitely, definitely apt, I think.
It is. She's a total badass. I love it. So how can we just backtrack a little bit? And like you say that there's this whole idea that women were just kind of subservient at this time. And can you talk to me a little bit about, I know you're a little bit earlier than the Tudor period, but certainly it influenced the Tudors, and we see it kind of extend even more, just how women in real life were seen at this time. Because it always blows me away, even in the Tudor period, how women joined guilds, and you know, there's all this stuff. They had jobs, and they were doing things, and there's this whole myth that women just stayed at home and pumped out babies, and it wasn't. They lived very vibrant lives, and very creative lives, and were entrepreneurs and everything like that. And so can you tell me a little bit about how the role of women and in England? And yeah, I'll stop talking and let you talk now.
Sure. Okay. So so when you think about where our ideas of what women were doing comes from, it comes from clerks and people who were trained in the church, right? And the church was Catholic Church at the time before Henry. And this is a time when it was very much the thinkers, the theological thinkers at the time, thought that women should be subservient. And so that was what they wrote about how they should be. This is what they should be like. But if you read anything outside of these intellectual texts, you read medieval plays, or you read the Fabliau, or you read court documents, you'll see that women are everywhere, and they're talking back, and they're going to court, and they're taking over businesses that they had to. I mean, Christine writes a lot of things for widows because she knows what it's like. And she had to fight for her, basically her debts that were her husband's in court for 14 years. And so, you know, if you look outside of what women should be like, you can actually see the real ones who were in professions. Now, they weren't in guilds very much because they weren't supposed to be, but often they were in the back of the shop that they were doing a lot of the work, but not getting a lot of the credit, which was pretty familiar for that period. But yeah, women were doing all sorts of things, but we don't really see them. And so it's kind of interesting to read Christine's work because she'll pull them out to the front. For example, she, after the City of Ladies, it was a bestseller. And so she wrote kind of a sequel called Book of the Three Virtues, where these three, Lady Rectitude, Lady Justice, and Lady Reason, come back and they tell her, well, here's what you can do as a woman of this time. Mm. And so Christine gives advice, or through these apparitions, gives advice as to how you should live. And so she gives advice for how a princess should live, which is basically support your husband and help him and be a kind of a moderator. Help them to be wise. For women that are lower ranks, she's saying, do your best to find out what the accounts are, what the money is like in your house, because you might need to know this later. Really be familiar with the business, things like that. But she even goes as far as to speak to prostitutes and say, you don't have to put on the red light. there are things that you can do. And she explains you could be a laundress or you could be a servant or you could do these things. And so you can kind of, reading Christine's work, even see where were the women that were doing all these things that they're not really mentioned as being done in the sermons, because the sermons were very much about, like, you stay home and take care of things, but it's not really kind of explained what they do necessarily. Mm-hmm. So yeah, women are busy at this time, and don't let anyone tell you that they were always quiet and not yeah. giving their opinion, because they were. In fact, that is the source of many of the stories, folk tales and stuff, is that women are being too mouthy, because mm-hmm. they have opinions, they're human beings. So yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. So, so Christine, her work then starts to spread. And was there any, you said Paris got too hot for her. What was yes. there any adverse reaction to her or people who, tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, it wasn't in reaction to her at all. What was happening in France at that time is, because Charles VI was ill, he was frequently absent from being king. And so there were lots of people that would take his place and fight over the regency. And so there's that. And then there was also kind of a blood feud that was happening between the House of Burgundy and the House of Orléans. And so those guys were fighting all the time. And they were shifting alliances with the English as well, because the English were still a threat. And so around 1418 is when she kind of disappears. And that's because the Burgundians had taken over Paris. And they were aligned with Henry V, the English king at that time. And it was not the time for a French patriot to be in Paris, especially one that was kind of aligned with the Dauphin and stuff. So it was not the right place for her to be politically. And we think that she probably retired to a convent where her daughter was. So Christine had three children, a daughter and two sons. One of her sons died, and so her daughter was a nun, a Dominican nun at Poissy. And then Jean de Castel, we know he was in England for a while. He died when he was 25, so she probably went to stay at Poissy with her daughter. And it was just a political thing. It had nothing to do with this.
I see. Okay. Yeah. And this is, like you said, this is the time of, like, Joan of Arc and Agincourt in a couple of years before then. So at this point, it looks as if the English are still really a threat then at that point. And we don't.
Yeah. At that time, the English are kind of ascendant, mm-hmm. which the tide turns, you know, 10 years later. But Christine wrote about Agincourt and just what a devastating time that was for the French aristocracy. She wrote kind of a letter of consolation to another noble woman. But so at that time, Charles VI had to acknowledge Henry V as being in charge.
Yeah.
And so she had to get out of Paris. Mm-hmm. And then 10 years later, just over 10 years later, Joan of Arc came in. Things were looking good for the French for the first time. And so Christine kind of took up her pen for the first time in a decade and mm-hmm. wrote this kind of song of praise to Joan, not knowing what was around the corner. But yeah, when she disappeared, it was a bad time for the French.
Yeah, okay. I see. Yeah, and then that's just, of course, for people who aren't familiar with the timeline, then that Henry V then becomes the this is like getting into the Wars of the Roses, well, the very early beginnings. Can you walk me through a little bit of the English timeline then, since this is a Tudor themed?
Yeah. So, okay. Like, oh my gosh, it's the end of my period. Let me just...
Well, now, so we have Henry V, the Conqueror, and then it's his son then who... Yeah. And it was his... How is that related? Because Henry VI's grandfather was the one who had some mental health issues, right? And that's Charles, or...
Charles VI, yeah. So what happened was Henry V married Charles's daughter.
Mm.
I think her name's Isabel. I might have got that wrong.
Yeah.
But anyway, Mary's Charles's daughter. Yeah. And so their son, Henry VI, inherits some of these difficulties. And, you know, it's one of those things where people are not exactly sure what the difficulty was.
Yeah.
But so Henry VI had a lot of times where he was fine, and then he had times where he was not. And so
people started to get restless about this, and then there was civil war over it. Maybe someone else should be king. And so that's when Edward IV takes over.
Yeah.
And so eventually Edward has Henry killed.
Yeah.
And after Edward comes his son. His sons were the princes in the Tower. And they're killed. And then his brother Richard III takes over. You know, Richard III was defeated by the first Tudor, Henry Tudor. Yep. And he married Elizabeth and brought the two houses together, the white and the red.
So just thinking about the relationship with England at this period too. So it's, you know, sometimes there's a stereotype that people just stayed on their little serfdom, their little fief, their little area, right? And they never went anywhere. And I just wonder, like, how did the French people and the English people interact? Of course there was war. So, but was there trading relationships? Like how did English people ever visit France? Did they go to the beaches? But they went on pilgrimages and things like that. Can you talk a little bit about, other than the war, which of course the war is a major part of it, but what the relationship would have been like between ordinary people at that time period?
Sure. There's a huge relationship between England and France. And this goes back to the Normans taking over England. For a lot of the medieval period, much of what is modern France was owned by the English. I mean, Eleanor of Aquitaine brought a whole bunch of that over when she married Henry II. And so they owned a lot of it. It was lost, and then it was gained, and lost and gained.
And
so,
that's kind of where the Hundred Years' War starts, isn't it? Is certain claims to the throne that they had and lands. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, and so there were relatives all over the place from this back and forth thing. There's marriages, there were people who were related, and so they're going back and forth to visit each other. There's trade, like you say, there's pilgrimage, which is a huge thing. Mm-hmm. People were on the move a lot more than we think. So yeah, there was a constant contact between the two, and the royal court of England was speaking French until about Richard II, when he was more into English, and that's kind of when Chaucer was becoming famous and things like that. But yeah, there was a huge relationship between the two, and it went back for centuries. Mm-hmm. So the literature that they were reading in France, they would get it in England. England to France, maybe not so much, because the people in France were not speaking English as much as the people in England were speaking French. Mm-hmm. And that's just, again, back to the Norman conquest and things like that. But yeah, they were crossing all the time.
Yeah. No, I just think it's interesting because a theme, what I've noticed about the talks that I've recorded so far, there's a lot of myth debunking going on at the moment in some of these talks. And I'm trying to kind of go with that theme and see some of the different myths that people have about these certain times in history and these people. I just had a conversation this morning about Catherine Howard not being a tart. And so that was fun to kind of debunk the Catherine Howard tart myth. And so I'm just trying to think about some of the, when you think about the Joan of Arc period or the Hundred Years' War period and the archers and all of that kind of stuff, there's this idea that I don't know, I imagine like Monty Python and the Holy Grail and stuff like that, right? He's carrying two coconut shells and he's banging them together. Like, yes. Oh, there's some lovely filth over here. Like, that it's just...
I know. To be a medieval historian is to debunk constantly. But actually, the Holy Grail is pretty good in that, you know, a bunch of those people knew a lot of stuff about the Middle Ages, especially Terry Jones. So, you know, the more you learn about the Middle Ages, the funnier that is. In fact, in Oxford, they had cups that were made with coconut shells. Kathleen Kennedy's working on medieval coconut shells. So it kind of, you know, another illustration of why the trade networks were, they were going as far as Africa, you know, routinely. So
they seriously had coconut shells?
Yeah, they did. I think like Kathleen Kennedy is working on a book about medieval coconuts right now. It's not out yet, but if you find her on Twitter, you know, you can ask her.
Wow.
So
what's the airspeed velocity of an unladen swallow and the coconuts and all of that? Yeah.
I can answer that one for you,
but you can talk about the coconuts. Okay, so thinking back to Christine, why is she worth knowing about now in the 21st century and studying her? What does she bring to us now 600 years later?
Okay, the biggest reason to read Christine is that it's putting another person back into place that we've just skipped over too much. People in the medieval fields know Christine now. She's pretty well known among medieval historians, but public at large, I think, doesn't know about her at all. Mm-hmm. And she's at least as important as someone like Chaucer, you know. So we need to put the women back into history. So that's number one. Mm-hmm. The next reason is to really get a better understanding of, I think, of the Middle Ages as well. Because if people are creating this type of an argument that is this well-reasoned, this is something that we don't think that people in the Middle Ages could do. We tend to think that they were dumb and, you know, wandering around gathering filth, which is not true. So if you haven't read kind of an intellectual argument, something like The City of Ladies is easy, and it also gets at the way that medieval people could put together an argument based on sources that they were read, and it will really give you an idea of how well read they could be. Mm. And then another reason is that many of these issues are still around, so it's immediately familiar to women, especially all of these things that have been kind of thrown at us for, you know, thousands of years. You can see her dealing with them one at a time. And so it's kind of hugely empowering. It's a little bit disturbing to know we're still dealing with many of the same issues, but you can feel Christine just dealing with this and having that confidence to say, no, I know that everyone else says this is true, but it's really, really not. So that's kind of empowering. And then the last thing is to really get an idea of what a medieval woman, what her life could have been like. So she didn't get into her biography as much in there, but in her other works, especially Christine's Vision, that one takes kind of the form of a complaint, a lot like the Consolation of Philosophy. In fact, that's kind of what she based it off of. And she explains the things she's gone through in her life, and philosophy consoles her. But you can see what she's gone through in her life. And so you can get an idea of a woman kind of in time, in her own time, in her own words, which is a rare thing. There's lots of reasons to read Christine, all the reasons. Start with The City of Ladies, because it's just a powerful book. But she should be well known to us now, because she was well known at the time. Mm-hmm. And we need to start putting women back into history, because we've skipped over them for way too long. And that was intentional. Mm-hmm. I mean, the fact that she wasn't translated again until the 1980s is kind of ridiculous. And even in the Tudor period, her stuff that was being printed, the men who were translating it were saying, well, this book is attributed to Christine, but that's because she gathered clerks around her, so she's kind of like a patroness, so it's not really Christine, but we'll say that it was. When it definitely was her, like, her picture is in the book. So yeah, lots of reasons to read her, just to, like I say, put her back in her time where she belongs.
Yeah. That's so great. I've learned so much about her. So where people should start with City of Ladies, and where, what else is there to, what other resources, how can people learn more about her?
Most of her stuff is kind of in academic editions, but if you just go to Amazon, for example, and put in Christine de Pizan, you have a whole bunch of things that are accessible to you, and they're paperbacks, and the price is not too bad, which is good. So, and I think this is mainly because they're trying to get more people to read Christine, especially as students. Mm-hmm. So the prices are not too bad. So you can find her easily now if you know to look for her. Yeah. And I think she's popping up, I think in your blog post you said she's popping up in Alison Weir's novels as well, so that's fantastic.
Yeah. So tell me then, I want to give you an opportunity to talk about you and your work and how people can learn more about you and connect with you and everything like that. So tell me something about you.
All right. So I write under the name of The 5-Minute Medievalist, which is kind of accidental. I started writing a blog that was to make everyone else a medievalist in 5 minutes, but it stuck to me. So I write as The 5-Minute Medievalist, and many of my articles are on medievalist.net. And so you can see there the stuff I've written, and it's just stuff that I've come across that I find is interesting that I think will draw people into history. And so that's what I write. So I have my own website, which is DanielleSobolsky.com, which I hope we can put in notes because I know that my name is difficult to spell.
No, I'll have a link right below this video. So it'll be linked.
So I'm doing a few things. I'm writing little survival guides. My first one was the 5-Minute Medievalist Guide to Surviving the Zombie Apocalypse, which I hope will help people connect now to then and really understand people back then. I'm also coaching authors to help them get their history right, because people want authentic history in their novels now, or TV. So I'm doing that a little bit. And right now I'm frantically writing a book for Pen and Sword Press, which should be out next year. And it's right now, the working title is Medieval Europe in Fact and Fiction. Nice. So all that stuff is on the website. You can find it there.
So also, because somebody, when I posted about speaking to you, or that you were on the roster, when I posted the roster, somebody said, what's a medieval coach? So can you just tell me a little bit, like if somebody is writing a historical fiction novel, for example, they can come to you to check their history?
Yeah, so I've built it as a coaching model because I feel like it's more collaborative, and I feel like a lot of people who are writing novels, they want to work through ideas instead of being told their history. Yeah. So I've made it so that whatever you need, I can offer. So if you just need some references, I can give those to you. If you need to solve a plot point in a way that works, I can do that. If you need someone to just go through your manuscript and just make sure that the history works, and I'm there for that as well. So I made it a coaching model in case you're like, I have this thing, I need the plot to go here, but I don't know how to do it in a way that's authentic. So we can work that out together. And so that's why it's called a coaching model. Nice. That's why I call it a coaching model.
Yeah, no, that's great. I just wanted to give you a chance to explain that a bit. So yeah, for all the budding historical fiction novelists out there, checking out.
It saves you the work of having to do it yourself, right?
Yeah.
That's the idea.
For sure. Well, I have learned so much. Thank you so much for sharing about Christine and medieval France. And it's really great to have this kind of background, because it's interesting. Sometimes you want to put people in this bubble. There's like a 16th century bubble, but it was informed by what had happened in the past. And certainly I love the idea of Christine's work being in all of these libraries of like Louise of Savoy and all these different people.
Well, she was really, like I said, she was really well known, and I didn't realize before I started kind of refreshing on Christine before I talked to you that there's this tapestry in the Tudor court, and that it was in Elizabeth's wardrobe, and that was kind of amazing to me, especially because it was their inventory when Henry VIII died. So Elizabeth was a young girl. And so to have this tapestry of the City of Ladies for her is amazing. So thanks for giving me the chance to find that out.
That's great. I'm going to try to find, I guess there's probably images of that I can put here.
The tapestry doesn't exist anymore. Okay. Never been found, but there's a book about it.
Okay, so I will hunt that down and put that in a link down here too. Okay. Awesome. Thank you so much for sharing about Christine and medieval France with us. I really have appreciate you've been really generous with your knowledge and your time and everything.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.